For members only. Golf Smarter number 320, published on February 14, 2012. Do you say Happy Valentine's Day to your golf buddy?
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
More with Jim Waldron on consistency, distance, and accuracy.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Jim.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be back.
We never left. And that's it. I really appreciate you. I mean, when we started, I said, you got about 30 minutes? And you went, yeah, fine. And now we're going to go for another 30. So as long as your wife lets you have the phone, this is okay.
Right.
So we were talking about, you know, just in between the time we were recording, about the technicality here. And you were kind of apologizing for being so technical. But, I don't think that's an issue. I think people love to hear this kind of technical talk and detailed talk. But you say this is just not a common conversation. This is more like an argument that takes place in the teaching world?
It's a big raging argument. It has been for, I don't know, maybe the last 3 years especially, because there's so many older pros, guys my age or even older, I'm 60 now, who, you know, not for bad reasons, but for legitimate reasons, were basically, you know, the information at the time when they were younger pros was not 100%, but in general, if you look at the old PGA teaching manual especially, it doesn't say what people often accuse it of saying. But over time, because some well-known teachers, I won't even say who they are, but there's been some well-known teachers for years taught that the ball will start on the direction the path is pointing, that the club head is moving relative to the target line through impact, at the moment of impact. So if the club head is moving just before and just after impact down the target line, it never moves in a straight line, literally. I mean, it's moving in an arc. So if the tangent of the arc, which when the ball happens to be sitting there, where the club head approaches the target line, almost in a straight line, not literally, it's still moving in an arc, right? But if the club head itself is moving perpendicular to the target line as it hits the ball will go straight. Now, obviously, that there should have been a a red warning flag. This is not, you know, the red warning flag is, it's also something that was understood by myself at the time when I was first coming up in the game, and a lot of teachers I know. That's assuming, of course, that the club face angle is not changing. Mm. The problem is that golf club head is one unit, right? There's something we call the golf club head, which is obviously attached to the shaft. Or I should say the shaft is attached to the club head. But it's possible to swing the club head path in one direction and have the club face angle pointing in a completely different direction. There's no guarantee the club face angle is going to be square to the arc of the club head path,
no,
right?
Of course not.
Yeah, because you can not change the shaft plane angle, which is another way of saying club head path, but you can change the face angle independent of what the shaft plane or club head path is, simply by rotating the muscles in your wrists. If you rotate the muscles in your wrists in a counterclockwise direction, the club face angle is going to close or point to the left. Rotate your wrists to the right in a clockwise direction, the club face is going to be open or point out to the right. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but on the other hand, if you have a proper grip and proper grip pressure, and that's two things. The third thing, you learn how to cock your wrists, or I should more accurately cock and hinge your wrist correctly, so that the club face stays square to the arc of the path as you do the wrist cock and wrist hinge, and you swing on plane, which is another way of saying having 0 degrees of club head path at impact, you're gonna hit a pretty straight shot, right? It's not gonna go way off to the right or left. It's not gonna curve very much or even at all. And in the real world, most people who have path problems, or let me put it this way, in the real world of golf, most golfers who have directional starting line direction problems, not curvature problems, people who push the ball off the tee, for example, or people who pull the ball off the tee, they don't have that problem because of face angle, typically. I mean, there are people who do, for sure, but it's probably less than 10% of amateur golfers. 90% of amateur golfers, if they pull the ball, they pull the ball because they come over the top and they reroute the club head path from on plane to severely out to in, i.e. pointing to the left to impact. And their club face angle is basically square to that path, or maybe very slightly open, more commonly, very slightly. So the ball will start out to the left of the target line, sometimes way left, and then curve moderately, typically to the right.
But aren't the wrists and the arms working independently of each other? So like your path and your point of contact will be different because it's not all one unit there.
Well, that's part of the challenge of learning good golf swing mechanics. You've got to train the three main subsystems, which are your pivot, how your body rotates, how your upper arms work, how your right elbow bends and straightens, and your forearms rotate, if any, and your wrist cock and hinge. Those are the three subsystems. In a good golf swing, they work as a team in synchrony with each other, and the result is a club face angle these days for most of the swing, until just before impact, stay square to the arc of the path. That's what you want. You know, if you want a backswing where the club face angle changes not at all, it stays square to the path, and you want a path that's on plane, right? Not severely in to out, not severely out to in, which looks simple and clean. When you look down the line view, if you look at almost all the young players today, they swing it pretty much exactly on plane. Whereas if you look at someone like Jim Furyk, he looks like he's got like 16 different loops and dips and curls in his motion, right?
Right, right.
You can see the loops that go to take place. So he's changing his path dramatically, right? But if you don't change your path dramatically, swing the club shaft on the proper plane angle, which is, again, swinging on the proper path, just a different way of describing it, and you don't rotate the face open or shut at all on the backswing, you keep it square to the arc, then it's just simply a matter of how you let the club head release when you let your wrist cock angle open up. On the downswing, do you add forearm rotation, or do you keep the club face square to the arc, you know, through impact, or do you let the club face go the other way, open up a little bit at some point? It depends if you want to hit the ball straight, if you want to draw the ball, if you want to hit a little fade, right?
Right.
So there's options there. But what you don't want is a big change, if any. If you are going to change the face angle a tiny bit during release, you don't want a big change to in terms of shutting it, because then you'll get a big hook. Right, because it'll be too big a difference between the path and the face angle. It'll start to the left, and it'll curve more to the left. And you don't want a big change in the face angle to the right, because it'll start to the right of your target line, and it'll curve more to the right. So the reason why people have this argument that's just so, it's just on the golf swing forums, it's still raging. For some reason, it hits people's emotional buttons. Right? People forget, and I posted this before. Here's what I say in a nutshell. I say, here's the deal. It's better to think about the old ball flight laws for the transition into the downswing. And even at the very first part of release, the old ball flight laws have more influence on what the ball does than the new ball flight laws. Even though the new ball flight laws are correct from a physics standpoint and the old ball flight laws are incorrect. In other words, it's much more important for the average golfer especially to understand what's happening well before impact than it is at the moment of impact. Because there's nothing you can do to influence impact.
Right. But I have a question about impact, about my left hand, and this is a question about me, not about golfers. When I'm making contact at that point of impact and contact with the ball, should the back of my left hand, where should it be pointing?
It depends on how you grip the club. I hate to sound like an equivocator, but it's true. Although I am an equivocator, just kidding. But it depends how you grip it. If you grip it really strong with your hand, your left hand well over to the right of the club face when you grip it, right? So maybe like you get all your knuckles showing, like a Paul Azinger or a Fred Kuppel or a Bernard Langer type of grip, right?
Mm-hmm. When you say all my knuckles are showing, wait. You mean that I can when I'm looking down, I can see all the knuckles on the
left
hand?
Yeah, when you're in a dress and you have... Yeah, okay. On the left hand, you should. If you can see more than three knuckles or more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you probably don't want to have less than that showing. So let's say you had three knuckles at address.
I don't.
You
have two.
Only had one knuckle. Okay. Let's say you have two, mm-hmm. and you can only see one knuckle or even half a knuckle at impact.
Mm-hmm.
you're going to hit a pull hook. If that's it's going to start to the left, and it's going to, well, again, assuming your path is either on plane or out to the right a little bit, you're going to hit a pull hook if that's where your left hand is at impact.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you rolled your forearm counterclockwise too much, which is why if you grip it too strong in your left hand, you cannot let that natural momentum type of left forearm counterclockwise rotation aspect of release happen without hitting even a severe snap hook where it starts way left, barely gets airborne, you know, just dives into the ground.
Yeah.
So this is in the opposite. If you look down at a dress and you only have a half a knuckle, right?
Mm-hmm.
You better pretty much have a half a knuckle at impact. If now you've got knuckles showing, if you what we call reverse roll your forearms and you roll clockwise during release or at any time during the swing, doesn't really matter, then the face is going to be open relative to probably where your path is going to be. Mm-hmm. And it'll start to the right and it'll fade to the right, slice to the right. So
well, one of the
that's
things
why
that
a good grip is so important. You don't want to have, if you're like most people, you don't want to have a severely weak or severely strong grip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which basically means for most people, I don't like to use a knuckles thing. It's easy to do it over a radio, you know, a podcast interview, but there's actually a better way to do it using a mirror. But you know, it'll do for now. So basically, if you're around two and a half knuckles, and you have the club shaft pretty much right where your zipper is, maybe a little bit to the left of your zipper, then that's probably in the ballpark of being a good grip.
Okay. It's interesting because we talked about it briefly earlier on the last episode. But when I address the ball, I can see two knuckles. Okay. But when I make contact, I can see three, maybe four. Okay. And
that's not good. That means the face is open.
Yeah.
That means you're going to hit a lot of slices.
Yeah. I'm going to hit the ball. It's going to fade or it's going to slice.
Again, assuming if you swing on plane or have a good club head path, that ball's going to start to the right of your target line,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to slice off to the right even further.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in reality, most pros have good grips. They don't have extremely strong or extremely weak grips. There are exceptions. Fucking most pros have around the two knuckles, right? And the right hand is pretty similar. It's not way underneath the shaft or way over to the pointing to the left. It's pretty much, you know, close to mimicking the left hand.
And you're saying in front of the zipper.
I'm talking relative to club face. I mean, they don't have their right hand too far to the right or too far to the left. It's sort of, you know, it's a little bit. Most pros have both palms a little bit, anywhere from 10 to 20 degrees to the right of the club face angle when they hold on to the club.
Mm-hmm.
Which means the V's, which I think are better than the knuckles. The V's,
right. The V's between the thumb and the V being the
That V will point somewhere between the right ear and the tip of the right shoulder. Most of them are right, almost exactly in the middle between those two extremes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Between the right ear and the right shoulder, right in the middle there.
I would never have noticed that position on my hand at impact if it wasn't for the work I've been doing on the range with the Tour Striker.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing to me how much I learned about my swing with just one bucket with that Tour Striker.
Because you're doing that mistake because you don't trust the idea that if you hit down, it'll go up. You're trying to add loft by opening the face.
Right.
I mean, you're subconsciously doing it. I know you're not doing it consciously, but your subconscious mind thinks, if I hit down with this tour, with any club, not just a Tour Striker, I'm going to drive the ball deeper into the ground. It's not even going to get airborne. And so what happens is, this is the beauty of what I call the mind-body connection. Your subconscious sends an impulse to the muscles in your left forearm, and you reverse roll, you roll clockwise, which adds loft to the face and also makes the point off to the right, both at the same time. And you're probably going to be flipping your wrist sideways, too. Your right wrist is going to probably flip, you know, toward the target, to the left, right? And that will also add loft, although it'll shut the face. It has the opposite effect. But the point is you're going to try to do one or both of those things at the same time to add loft,
mm-hmm.
to try to scoop it. And that's... You know, that's what I spend a lot of my time. I make a lot of my living. I probably make 20% of my annual income teaching people not to do that.
Mm.
Seriously. Which is why I like Martin's invention. I like the Tour Striker. I think it's a great training aid.
Yeah, he has come up with something really, really, because I, you know, I get thrown to these training aids all the time. And I'm like, but this one, like, as soon as I hit a ball with it, I was like, oh, It made so much
sense.
Yeah, it's a
big light bulb, isn't it?
It really is. It made so much sense to me. And he's a great guy, and I'm just so happy for him that, you know, that he's come up with something that works and the people love, and, you know, I mean, and it just makes so much sense.
That's why, you know, from a teaching standpoint, I always say, I keep reiterating, I mean, every podcast I tell, I've said this to your listeners, you know, it doesn't matter what you think intellectually. Your body only listens to your subconscious when you're moving at normal speeds in any sport. Now, if you're moving in super slow motion, yeah, right, then your intellectual mind can control your body. But you can't play golf in slow motion.
No.
You know, William James said it. I think I've used this quote before with you. You know, the founder of American psychology said back in, I think it was in 1905, he said, in a conflict between the will, in parentheses, conscious mind, and the imagination, in my parentheses again, subconscious mind, the imagination always wins. Always. In other words, if you want to lose weight only at the level of intellectual understanding and your subconscious wants to keep eating, you know, a lot of sugar, a lot of carbs, you're going to fail at your weight loss program.
Right.
You have to want the change at a deeper level of your mind for the change to become a reality. And it's the same way in teaching golf. I mean, I had a guy who was scooping so bad trying to add loft. I mean, we tried everything. This was before the Tour Striker, which I got last summer. I tried for 2 hours everything I know, and the guy wasn't really getting better, right? I finally took him to, we're lucky because the front of our range, when we get this past where the range is cut, you know, short for people to hit off of, it goes down at about a 45-degree angle on a hill for about maybe 30 feet. Hmm. And the only way I got this guy to hit down was to have him hit off a 45-degree angle downward slope. And I said, let your back leg go forward so it crosses over your front leg just after impact. Kind of like that Gary Player walkthrough drill, you know, people talk
what?
About.
What?
And finally, after an hour of doing that, he was hitting down. And, of course, as soon as he hit down, the ball went up in the air really high. And he finally got it. But until then, it was like a wrestling match between me and his subconscious.
Mm.
That's what it is. That's what I do all day.
You're not
gonna, people's subconscious.
Yeah, and you're not going to win.
I do win eventually because I'm good. But sometimes I need more time, which gets back to the golf school. By the way, that's the advantage of a golf school in an all-day format versus a one-hour lesson. You have more time to finish and win the wrestling match with the student's subconscious.
I see.
So that's literally that's the big advantage of doing an all-day boot camp, 8-hour-a-day total immersion golf school. We wear down the old movement patterns because we help the student have more and more. It's not just one light bulb in 3 days. It's like you know, 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 light bulbs a day for 3 days in a row.
Right. Well, how does somebody know
when
searching for a golf school? How do they know that they're on the right track? I mean, what should they be looking for? What, you know, they, because there's so many golf schools out there, so many opportunities, and you've never worked with these people before. Most likely, you're going to travel to go to do this.
Right.
And, you know, the follow-up now, luckily, because of the web, you can do follow-up. That's great, because you really need that. But how do you know this is going to be the right school? What is it that we should be looking for?
If I was a golf school consumer, here's what I would think. First of all, you've got to realize what the expectations of the average. Probably the average golfer, to put it mildly, has unrealistic expectations for how to go about improving their game. It's like that guy I mentioned. He thought he was at graduate school level of learning and training, and he was still in preschool. He just didn't know it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you do is, first of all, avoid anybody who promises instant, permanent, swing-like-a-pro results. It's just not going to happen. Now, it may happen on some shots in the golf school, and that does happen for most of our students in our golf schools. We get people hitting some of their shots like a pro. But we also tell people before they sign up, look, this is a process that you're starting. This is a journey. If you think you're going to come to the school and we're going to teach you in 3 days how to swing like a pro after you leave, and that's going to be your swing that you'll take to the golf course for even most of your rounds of golf, you're kidding yourself. And then I usually say as a joke, by the way, we do have that school. That one costs $1 million.
All right.
You know, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, right.
It can't be done. If anybody's promising that level, I'm talking permanent improvement in 3 days, then obviously avoid those people like the plague because they're liars, right? They're con artists. Mm-hmm. What you want to expect is to get information that you can use for the rest of your life to get better at golf, right? Even if it's just, again, the early stages of learning, even though it will be only theoretical, you want rock-solid information, and you want to learn how to learn it. My operating assumption is that my students don't know how to learn it, because I know from 20 years of doing this that 95 out of 100 people have no idea how to learn golf skills. Hmm. They don't know there are rules for learning effectively. And so we cover that in the first day, the morning of the first day especially. And you have to learn from the golf school how to practice effectively, both home practice, which is the most effective way to practice, not range practice. But there also is a need for some range practice. So there's two types of practice: what you do at home, which is probably 80% of that slow motion mirror work, and what you do at the range. And there are rules for effective practice. So if they're going to teach you how to learn, what to learn, the content, the mechanics, the information, and how to practice it so that number four on the list, you end up at some point in the future, and not 10 years out, but more like, 3 months out, 6 months out, 9 months out, you start to strike the ball significantly better most of the time, 80% of the time or more often. That should be your goal. Not to expect to walk away with after 3 days with a new golf swing. But, people tell us that all the time. People go, I almost didn't come because I knew my buddies would tease me if I took this golf school, spent all this money for 3 days. And if I come back, I'm not 1,000% better at ball striking. They're going to tease me and say you wasted your money. I go, can you name any other skill-based activity in the world that if you went away for 3 days, you'd be expected to perform like a professional or even close to a professional? Yeah. If you went to a violin camp or a piano camp for 3 days, and none of your music friends would say to you, oh, you're still playing Rachmaninoff really badly. why aren't you playing like a pro? Why aren't you playing the violin like Itzhak Perlman? What's the matter? What happened? Did that golf school rip you off? Only golfers think like that.
Yeah, it's incremental. And you've got to accept that it's going to be incremental, not exponential,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a process. Yeah. So that's what people should expect. And the irony is the people who come to us, even though they hear this, it's on our website, we tell people, because, the more successful you are as a teacher, the more those kind of students flock to you because they hear about you in the media or from word of mouth that you're a great teacher, and they assume that you have some kind of magic touch that you're going to touch their shoulder and they're going to become an instant better ball striker. So it's even harder for people like myself with kind of national reputations, right? Because we get that type of person. So the irony is the people who come to us with exactly the opposite attitude don't have zero expectations. In fact, people say to me, I don't expect to improve at all in the next 3 days. I'm probably going to be worse when I leave. And, of course, that never happens. People always leave better than when they started, right? Most people are significantly better. Again, not permanent yet because they haven't had time to make it a habit. But they're definitely hitting the ball better than when they first arrived. But the guy who has that attitude, who has zero expectation, is the guy who improves the most in the 3 days. And the guy who thinks he's going to learn it all in 3 days is the one who struggles the most. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that should be a lesson to all your listeners. the more you expect, the more you self-sabotage.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Expectations, you're going to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. You literally get in your own way. It retards learning.
And if you have no expectations, you can't be disappointed.
Yeah, well, when you have no expectations, one thing happens is you've got these, we call the three centers. You've got a mental center, a movement or body center, and an emotional center. And they're all three, this is why we have a triangle as our logo for our company. All three influence, each of those three centers influence the other two, right? So you could have a PGA Tour Pro level mental center, meaning the ability to focus your mind, like we talked about in the last podcast, a couple months ago. You could have a PGA Tour Pro body in terms of fitness, core strength, flexibility, body awareness, feel sense awareness, right? And you could have a severely neurotic Woody Allen, nebbish kind of, what I'm talking about? Kind of,
yes.
Yeah, nebbish,
I know. Like,
I know all the English words. I'm Irish Catholic. I know I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. But the point is you could have a very neurotic, fear-based, anxiety-based emotional center, and it'll retard learning. It'll inhibit you in the other two. It'll contaminate the other two, the mind and the body. So that's a part of golf that's almost never discussed. But, I mean, the emotions have a huge impact on how you learn, how you practice, and obviously how you play. So we say we want a quiet emotional center. We want a calm, almost neutral, for learning especially. The more you can keep your emotions sort of in neutral gear, the better you're going to learn. Mm-hmm. But the more you have ego or emotion attached to having a successful learning outcome, the harder it is going to be to learn. Mm. So that means you have to, you know, if you want to be a good golf school student, you want to, ideally, before you leave your house to come to see us or any other golf school, you should basically be willing to fail. Embrace failure. Say to yourself something along the lines of, well, I'm going to probably hit a lot of bad shots in the next 3 days. That's okay. I'll learn from my mistakes, right?
Right.
But if you're the kind of person who says, as soon as I hit two or three bad shots in a row, you know, I'm going to quit. I'm not going to follow the program. Then that person's not going to learn anything.
No.
And I've seen students try a new way of understanding the golf swing. Say again, back to wrist. Let's say we're working on wrist cock. And I've had a person literally walk away when I'm halfway into a five-minute lecture demonstration, leave the group, which is all just, you know, people standing around in a group in a circle, walk over to his little spot on the tee, grab a ball, take a full-speed swing in his mind, thinking about what I just said, but not doing it, just thinking about it, right? Pop the ball and look at me and say, well, that doesn't work. And then be upset
about
it.
You suck, Jim.
And I'm like, wait a minute, you didn't do what I asked you to do in your wrist. You did your old wrist mechanics, and that's why you topped the ball. There's a difference between thinking about doing it and actually physically doing it,
sure.
Right? But again, the person whose ego, in a very neurotic way, is so wrapped up in achieving success and avoiding failure at all costs, that guy is learning dysfunctional for golf. Hmm. So, you got to approach it with a healthy emotional attitude to be successful.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you said about your students, people who come to your school, is the first thing they'll tell you is, I need more distance, right? I want more distance.
Yeah, that's pretty common, yeah.
Very common,
yeah.
I would think. How mm-hmm. often do you get people say, I need more accuracy?
Not in fact, I'll give you the order of the three things. Consistency, accuracy, distance are the three primary goals for ball striking. Number
yeah.
one of those three by far is consistency.
Okay. And well, how do they define consistency? I mean, it's like I had a guy say to me on the golf course, he says, you know what I want for Christmas this year? Two good shots in a row. I thought that was great.
Yeah, that's like a gambler going to Vegas and saying I want to win, you know, win at the roulette table two times in a row, or a blackjack two times in a row. No, we actually define it for people. Most people don't really know. They have sort of a vague conceptual understanding of what consistency means. Mm-hmm. We tell people, look, I go, if you could hit somewhere in the vicinity of your target, not exactly the target, but you know, either at the target exactly, or you know close to it, you know, if you want to be more precise, we could say the driver, for example, the hardest club in the bag to hit for most people. Let's say the guy's hitting five fairways around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Out of 14 fairways in a typical round of golf, you'll hit a driver 14 times off the tee. And I would say for someone like that, if they could get it up to, you know, 10 or 11 fairways around, that'd be a pretty one specific way to define consistency. But in general, we say if you can hit your target or close to your target 8 out of 10 times on the range first, because it starts there first before it transfers to the golf course, that would be a reasonable goal. And we define that as skill. And if you're just the opposite, if you're hitting at or close to your target 1 out of 10 times, that's luck.
Wow.
So the beginner can do that.
Yeah.
The total beginner could do that, right? And most of our students are probably in their 3 to 5 range.
Okay.
And so they want to move from, say, a 4 or a 5 to like a 7 or an 8.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get there, they're really happy, and their scores start coming down, because the number one stat for lower scores for all skill ranges, from pros to beginners, is greens and regulation. And that means your first shot, your tee shot, has to be decent, because if you hit it in the rough and you're an average golfer, unless you bomb it a mile off the tee, you're probably not going to hit the green in your second shot. So that beats ball striking, which is, you know, it's something I've always talked about for years. I call it the short game myth. The myth is that short game and putting is the only way, or the main way, to significantly lower your scores, and it's just not true. I mean, if you don't count the kick-in putts, the gimme putts,
mm-hmm.
right? Take those away, and putting in the short game combined are not as many shots as most people think they are, right?
Really?
And the other reason why I say that is if your ball striking skills are good, it automatically I mean, 80% of the fundamentals in the short game are the same fundamentals as they are in the long game, which most of my students, when they first come to see us, don't know. They think there's a whole separate set of fundamentals that are completely different between short game and long game. In reality, there's a set of universal fundamentals that are common to both, and there's a set of separate, unique fundamentals common to the short game, right? Both things are true. But you're wasting your time trying to learn the unique aspects, the unique short game fundamentals, if you haven't mastered the universal fundamentals common to both first,
okay.
Like spine angle, like balance, like finish, like wrist cock or wrist cock release, like weight transfer, like pivot. If you haven't mastered the grip, setup, aim, and alignment, if you haven't mastered those things that are common to both short game shots and by short game's not putting. Putting's a separate game. But if you haven't mastered those fundamentals that are universal, then you're going to basically suck at short game and long game.
and I have to believe that the people come in when they say, I want to be more consistent. And you say, well, hit a couple balls for me. And you're standing there watching them. And you just see that you have to make some major changes in their address, their approach, their grip. You know, the basics there that they're like, no. I'm fine with that. I just want to be more consistent.
That gets back to part one. That's the guy I mentioned in part one. He thought he had already known all that. He didn't need to know that again.
Do most people feel that way, though?
Yes. Again, not wanting to be an equivocator, to be honest. But, well, he was an extreme example, which is why I'm using him.
Right.
Because the gap between where he thought he was and where he actually was in terms of his physical skill was way bigger than the average person I work with. But the average person I work with has the same quote-unquote disease or neurosis, but at a much, much more milder level. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, most people have never learned the basics. I hear it all the time. I even get people who are single digits, like 7-8 handicaps, come to see me, and they say, oh, for some reason, all of a sudden, I can't chip the ball anymore. And then I watch him chip, and I don't say anything for 5 minutes. And at 5 minutes, they'll maybe hit, I don't know, 15 chips or so, say, right? Mm-hmm. And of the 15, none have what I would consider proper mechanics, not one out of the 15.
Wow.
But of the 15, he'll put three or four within a foot or two of the hole, right? And then he'll put, three or four just terrible, not even hit it on the green or being way over the green or way short. Right? And the rest will be, 8 feet from the hole. Right? And he'll go, see, I can put three or four pretty close. And then I say something like, to be honest, because this is my teaching style, I go, well, the problem is that even the ones that are even the three that are within, short putt range, say a foot or three or 3 feet away, those are also mishit.
Wow.
He'll go, well, what do you mean they're mishit? I go, they were mishit. You didn't hit it solid. You chunked it a little bit, or you hit it a little thin, but because your path and your face angle was good, they went pretty straight, and you got lucky on the distance control. And it's the same. In other words, the same flaw that caused all the other shots to be much worse is present, but it was compensated for through luck. In other words, your subconscious is trying to guess how to do it right if you don't really know how to do it right, like a pro,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes it compensates. Just the right amount to the right degree for your bad technique, and you can chip it in the hole. You can hole it out, right? It's still a miss hit. It has to sound a certain way at impact. It has to look a certain way to someone like me who has a good eye for this, or on video if you want to tape it. It has to have a certain contact with the ground after impact. Not too much of a divot, not too much of a downward blow. Not too little of a downward blow, but just the right amount of downward blow for that particular shot they're trying to hit with that particular club. So these are all what I would call laws of shot making. There's certain things that must occur for it to be struck properly, right? And most people don't know what those laws are. They just know that every once in a while they get it close, and most of the time they don't.
I can't tell you how many times I've been on a driving range, and you talk about consistency is hitting their target. Like 8 to 10 times if they're all lucky. But people are like, it's not even a target. I mean, if they hit the ball straight one time, they'll go, okay, I'm ready. I'm done. That's what I was looking for. I got it, right? And it's not even hitting a target. It's just hitting it straight.
Yeah, exactly.
So accuracy doesn't fall that high on this. I would think that accuracy would be huge versus distance.
Well, for people who are really, really high handicappers who slice a lot, that's obviously number one.
Mm-hmm.
Although we don't get as many of those people as we used to because the technology today is... It's hard to slice it bad or hook it bad. Typically slice it bad.
Yeah.
Because of the game.
If they're fit properly for their clubs.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid growing up with, I actually played with hickory shafted clubs from 1903, I think they were, my grandfather's clubs.
You didn't start playing in 1903.
I didn't. I'm not that old. But I played my grandfather's clubs with hickory shafts, wooden shafts. It was super flexible. And the heads were really heavy. They had like lead shot embedded in the bottom of the sole of the club, so they were, which was great for talking about a training aid. It's like having a training aid. What you want as a golfer when you're learning is relatively flexible shafts, so you can feel the head, so you can feel the shaft bend, you feel the so-called lag pressure, help time your release, right? And you want a heavy head to get feedback so your hands wake up. So those are heavy clubs overall. They're very heavy, but flexible shafted with heavy heads are like the ideal way to learn golf, in my opinion. You're going to hit them real crooked, for sure. They're going to go plus the ball back then, the old wound ballada ball. You could easily hit 150-yard slices or hooks in the air. 150 yards, curvature, easy.
Wow.
And today, maybe you'll slice it 50 yards if you're really – I can't imagine how you could possibly slice it more than that. So that hasn't been as big an issue, especially in the last 10 years with these new high-tech drivers. But, no, it's just consistency. What drives people crazy, Fred, is being inconsistent, particularly in their long game, where they can hit a decent shot by their – let's say they're a 15 handicap. They hit it like a 15 handicapper would for their average shot. And then they'll follow it with a shot like a 30 handicapper. And so there's like an identity crisis. The person goes, wait a minute, am I a 30 or a 15 here? Who's in control of my body? Right?
Yeah.
Then if you hit the third shot like a 30, right – now they're going to have a nervous breakdown right in the middle of the golf course. So this is the nature of golf. It drives
right.
The same thing applies to a zero handicap. A zero handicap might hit like a plus five, like a tour pro in one shot, and like a 15 in the next. It drives him crazy too. So
it's playing Ray golf.
Ray Ray?
Yeah. You don't know
Never
Ray
that. What does that mean?
You don't know Ray Ray golf?
I don't know.
Oh, you hit one shot like Ray Floyd and the next one like Ray Charles.
I've never heard that. That's a good one. I'm writing this one down.
Oh, really Jim, good. It's been great to talk to you again. Thank you so much. And listen, safe travels. Best of luck in Asia and Singapore starting your school. But I want to send people to balancepointgolf.com and check it out. Obviously, Jim is a very articulate and educated instructor. And you should look into speaking with him yourself. And at the very least, go back into the older Golf Smarter episodes that Jim's been on, and you're going to learn a tremendous amount. Thanks so much, Jim, for coming back on.
Fred, it was a pleasure. Let's do it again sometime soon.
Those are the invitations I like. Speaking of invitations, I'm going on vacation later this week down to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. And while there, I'll be playing around at Villa Vallarta, and am planning to come back with a video tee tour to introduce you to the course and a Golf Smarter conversation with their general manager. Oh, I don't think I remember to tell you that there's a new Golf Smarter TV video up on YouTube. It's a tee tour of Sevillano Links in Corning, California, plus the awesome adventure I had with my friend Steve in getting there. So in regards to my vacation, if you're one of those two, who download and listen to each new episode as soon as it's published, thank you. Also, a programming note that the next show will be a couple of days late. But coming up on number 321, it's the first of another two-parter with one of the hottest young stars in the world of golf instruction, our old friend Jeff Ritter. I'm telling you, when this guy goes big time, just remember where you heard him first. Anyway, Jeff and I talk about his new position as the National Director of Instruction at the Nike Junior Golf Camps and what this means to your child or to you. His new teaching partnership with his old college buddy, check it out, Martin Chuck. They went to college together. you know, Martin Tour Striker, and his report on the 2012 PGA Merchandise Show in Orlando. Also on our upcoming schedule, Jim Hardy will be joining us for the first time to introduce his new book, Solid Contact, Improve Your Swing No Matter What Your Handicap. And if you have any questions that you would like for me to ask Jim, or even to Martin Chuck, just click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.